Hello, it's Thursday, the 21st of March. I'm Alex von Tunzelman, and it doesn't really matter that I'm not allowed to join the Garrick Club on grounds that I'm a woman, because I can't afford it anyway. Welcome back to Paper Cuts, the modern newspaper review. Every day we nurture the British press like a delicate bonsai tree, misting it gently and carefully pruning its more demented branches to create a thing of beauty, or at least a thing of funny, we hope. Thanks to all you brilliant people who've joined the Paper Cuts Supporters Club. We love you and we always welcome more supporters. But if you want to help this show for free, just send three of your mates a text, WhatsApp or email telling them we're amazeballs. Include a link to papercutsshow.co.uk with two S's. There's a link in the show notes. If they listen and subscribe, we'll be cock-a-hoop. Now, here are the top stories for today's show. Got a brand new hunky president. World leaders go all eye of the tiger on us. Forever young, people in their 90s are changing their lives and we are so, so here for them. And unexpected item in the bagging area. Self-checkouts might be on their way out. Welcome to Paper Cuts. We read the papers so you don't have to. Thanks for joining us on Paper Cuts, where we're wearing shorts in the desperate hope it's spring. I'm Alex von Tunzelman, and with me today is Podmaster's Big Kahuna and Spring Roll, Andrew Harrison. Hello, Andrew.
Good morning.
And also with me is comedian and spring chicken, Matt Green.
Hello.
Andrew, what are the broadsheet front pages looking like today?
Well, The Guardian has that Garrick Club story. MI6 chief and civil service head resign from all-male Garrick Club. Both decide to quit their membership after list revealed in Guardian. That's Simon Case and Richard Moore. And they say, The Guardian is saying they're likely to put pressure on other members. I think it's really important that women should be allowed into a club full of boring old men or boring old men stuff. The Guardian also has a really powerful story about a woman who has ended their life at Dignitas after suffering from serious bowel cancer. Paola Mara died yesterday after calling for assisted dying to be legalised. I've got friends who know this woman and they've told me about how amazing she's been. She's been really getting the most out of her last days. And the story inside it's really moving. And the picture on the front is a portrait of her and she does not look sad, depressed, weakened or anything. I think she's a really brave and a strong woman and should be remembered well. And The Guardian has the shock of Leo Varadkar stepping down as Taoiseach. On The Telegraph, who is this muscular hunk pounding the crap out of a punch bag here? It's Emmanuel Macron in moody black and white, described by the French media as a show of ultimate virility. Mental health culture has gone too far, meanwhile, says the main headline, according to Mel Stride. Britain's approach to mental health is in danger of having gone too far, with the normal anxieties of life being labelled as illnesses, the Work and Pension Secretary has warned. Over on The Eye, UK on track for summit interest rate cuts after inflation falls. Boring but important.
And Matt, what have we got on the tabloids?
So again, a bit of a mixed bag. In The Mirror, a sad story about the Coronation Street legend, Julie Goodyear, whose husband has talked about her battle with dementia. On the front page of The Sun, another soap story, but very different one this. This is Coronation Street star Tina O'Brien caught in the middle of a vicious brawl between teenage girls near her home. And the headline is Street Fighter. Mm. And on the inside, they've got another lovely headline, which is The Strife O'Brien.
Oh, very good. That's pretty good.
That's good stuff.
On the front page of the Daily Mail, we've got the same story about mortgage rates, but very much sort of from the perspective of the government, really. Mortgage hope as economy turns a corner at last. Basically, it's going to be fine, guys. The other story, which has sort of not been covered as much by some of the other papers, is another Kate story. Three staff at the clinic are investigated over access to Kate's records, which could be quite a big story. And finally, The Star.
Ah, thank God.
Always the most important headline of every day, based about a gold rush happening because a big nugget was found by a detectorist. There's gold in them there Shropshire Hills.
Let's have a look at a couple of those stories in a bit more depth. Andrew, can you talk us through what has happened on this Rwanda bill that seems to be sort of interminably bipping about between the Commons and the Lords? Because, a couple of days ago, the papers were all sort of, the right-wing papers were all very pleased. They thought Rishi Sunak had really won something. He'd had a bit of a win. And now we're sort of back at the beginning, aren't we?
Well, yeah. I mean, this bill is now ping-ponging back and forth. The government has pinned its hopes on flights leaving by June. Rishi Sunak has made lots of very, very unwise commitments to judges by whether it happens or not. And it's getting pushed back and back and back.
There's quite a fun quote in Politico this morning about this, because he said, because the government said that flights will leave by spring. And now they're trying to define what spring means.
Right.
And so the Met Office has said that there are two definitions. Meteorological spring ends on May the 31st, but it also cites something called astronomical spring, which refers to the position of the Earth's orbit in relation to the sun, considering equinoxes and solstices. By this measure, spring only started this week and runs until June 20th. So I think Downing Street are going on astrological spring.
So we're now gauging government policy by kind of interplanetary measurement. Yeah. Like it's Battlestar Galactica or something. Yeah.
When's spring on Venus? I think we'll do it by then. Now, Boris Johnson once joked that G7 leaders should get hench, get their shirts off and flex their muscles to show that we are tougher than Vladimir Putin. Putin, of course, no stranger to the topless macho photo shoot. We must be thankful Johnson never acted on his threat. Suns out, guns out, no thank you very much. But the papers have been full of pics of stacked world leaders lately. Emmanuel Macron pummeling a punching bag like Rocky Balboa and Barack Obama flaunting his washboard abs at 62. Andrew, Macron, what is happening?
Well, as fitness correspondent, as a man who can bench press a water buffalo, I'm able to talk about this in some great detail. The guy's just beaten the crap out of Punchbag, really. It is, you know, it's as a piece of political positioning, it is remarkable. The veins on his forearm are standing out like whipcords. It is Le Grand Raging Bull. And French political commentators are definitely saying he's trying to echo Putin. It is part of an attempt, obviously, to project strength and virility. One does wonder whether people think this kind of stuff is going to play in Europe the way that it plays in Russia, where, shall we say, the judgment standards are slightly different. That said, the Times 2, has got a piece about Barack Obama has a flat stomach at 62. Barack's bod is the envy of all world leaders, says Damien Wentworth, my old colleague. You know, this is the idea that you're kind of literally the body politic, you know, that your levels of fitness and your physical incarnation somehow echo your political strength. It's a very strange and atavistic one.
It's a little bit of medieval kingship going on.
I wonder whether it's partly to do at the moment with the fact that both of the US presidential candidates are so obviously in bad physical condition, basically.
But to be fair, Trump's in his late 70s and Biden's in his 80s. They're not in bad shape for people of that age.
But, well, possibly. I mean, we have to remember that Trump's doctor did say in 2016, if elected, Mr. Trump, I can state unequivocally, will be the healthiest individual ever elected to the presidency, which is quite strong words for someone who's replacing Barack Obama.
But also, didn't the Trump's personal doctor look like he spent most of his time building a flux capacitor to travel back to the future?
He was a strange guy,
that doctor.
He did look like the sort of guy you'd not go to for some doctoring.
But the thing is, Barack Obama's got a flat stomach at 62. 62 is not old. And he's always been a very healthy and also a very slender fellow. Mm. Yeah. This is not surprising. Unless he's going to rip off the shirt and show us a six-pack, then I may have to revise my opinion.
And this kind of, you know, flaunting of physical power, I mean, as you say, it is definitely a bit medieval, but it's also something that, you know, we've definitely seen kind of authoritarian leaders do. I mean, Putin, the obvious one, but also Narendra Modi in India going on and on about his 56-inch chest and, you know, all of this sort of physical power being very important. Stalin making sure that he was always depicted untruthfully as a very tall man. He was actually 5'4" and, you know, with his sort of wonky arm fixed and all of this. You know, it's very important, that physicality to dictators. But this is democratic leaders doing that is a bit different, isn't it, Matt?
Yeah. It's interesting that they put it in black and white because everyone looks better in black and white. Mm. Because if you're in the gym and you're punching a punch bag, you're probably a bit hot and sweaty, probably a bit red-faced. Mm. But in black and white, you just look very cool, and sweat looks nice in black and white. And in colour, it just looks kind of clammy and odd.
This was taken by Macron's official photographer, who rejoices in the name Soisig de la Moissonnière.
Just all French people sound sexier than
they do.
I'm sorry. They just do. Even if they're not, they just sound it.
But releasing thirst traps of your French president is quite a thing, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's like, is Macron trying to ape Putin? Is he trying to make a point that he has become more hawkish now? He's made these speeches about how the Ukrainian crisis is a sort of existential crisis for Europe, and if we don't stop Putin now, then he'll be coming for us later. It's interesting. I don't know whether it will, as Andrew said, whether it will have the effect that he's looking for. He's a very vain man. I think that's what's clear about
Macron. Well, the French like vanity and we don't like vanity.
Yeah, that's the thing. I think it might work better in France than if Rishi Sunak did that, it would just be, you know, I mean, to be fair, Rishi Sunak tried to catch a rugby ball the other day and dropped it. So, you know, he's not going to be in the, you know, gym punching punch bags. But I think if we did it, it would immediately be memes. It would immediately be people taking the piss.
Surprisingly feel-good story from The Guardian. In fact, it's a wonderful feature by Amin Sana about people who get to their 90s and then decide to change their lives, write books, even take up new sports. It begins with Maybelle Blair, a baseball player for the Peoria Red Wings in the 1948 All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. Andrew, what did Ms. Blair do when she hit 95?
She came out. She said, I was in the closet for 95 years and that old door blew open. And she came on stage as well at the age of 95 and everybody cheered. One of those stories where actually everybody did stand up and cheer for once. Afterwards, I sat down and I had a beer and I tell you, I'd never been so happy in all my life. I was a new girl at 95, so you might have me for another 95 years. Good on you. You know, and it's if you are 95 years old, you've lived through a lot of different phases of opinion, of sexuality, of femininity, of where people fit into society. And, you know, it's the kind of thing we just look at it and go, you know, I hate to say it, but you tend to say, you go girl, don't you? That tends to be the response. Good on her. She says, the music is playing real loud for me and every step I take is a little more lively now that I can be who I am.
I love that. I love that, Chris. Great.
Good on her. And there's loads of other examples of people who've sort of, you know, done new things at what is a pretty old age. Edith Merway Trainer, who died last year at 101, took up weightlifting in her 90s and became the oldest competitive powerlifter at 99. And Charles Eugster, a British dentist, started bodybuilding in his 80s and became a sprinter at 95. He died at 97. So, you know, there's hope for us all. There's hope for even me and you, Matt. Even me and you.
Yeah. I could become a sprinter at 90. I'll wait until I'm 97 and then I'll become a sprinter.
Yeah. I mean, you don't want to go too early.
No. It's a good excuse for putting it off.
I do think, though, there's something incredibly inspiring about this, isn't there? In that, you know, we do have a culture that's very, very focused on youth, to be honest, don't we? I mean, there is a great kind of, you know, a great fetishization of youth, you know, being young, especially in sports and the arts and so on. And isn't it kind of completely delightful if we are living longer these days to think that actually we've got plenty more chances to make this work?
Yeah, there's loads of great stories in the article. It's really worth reading. It reminds me, I had a friend who was a stand-up comedian and she started doing stand-up in her 70s. And she died in her late 80s. So, you know, she was someone who really took the... She was called Lynn Ruth Miller. She was brilliant. And
she had a longer run than many stand-up comedians.
Exactly, yeah. And she was an open spot at the age most people are retiring and she was sort of starting out and it was fantastic. And in this story, there are people... sounds like an amazing woman called Mildred Kirschenbaum, who became a social media star at the age of 99. She was on a cruise with her son and daughter to celebrate her birthday. Her daughter put a video on the internet and it went viral. My favourite story, though, in this piece is one of the sort of quieter ones in a way. It was a guy called Derek Skipper, who at the age of 92 took GCSE maths and passed more than 75 years after he took the equivalent in the 1940s. And I just really like that because it's not just about, you know, people becoming social media stars and bodybuilders and stuff. It's like people just still doing something with their brains. And there's a great quote, which says, the maths course kept me much more interested than sitting down watching TV. And I thought, yeah, that's great. You know, some people are still using their brains, still using the time they've got to do something interesting with their lives. And they don't have to be sort of presenting it on screen for it to be worthwhile.
Now on Paper Cuts, we take the mickey out of them, but you know we love them really. It's the headlines of the day. What do you have for us today, Andrew?
Well, I'm the winner today because I've got the Star, home of Prattle of Animals, home of headline excellence. They have a story. Brian Blessed said it was torture filming Flash Gordon with a cable strapped around his groin for flying scenes. The foghorned actor played Prince Vulton, leader of the Hawkmen in the sci-fi flick, headline, bashed Gordon.
Oh, good, good.
Bless him, I was strung up by private parts in Flash Stunt. That's Flash Stunt. So that's tremendous stuff on page three. Then we move to page nine, where we have the story of the IT crash at Greggs. Mm. Sausage roll fans were left fuming yesterday after Greggs was forced to close stores when an IT glitch torpedoed tills. Pastry lovers had to go hungry after the tech cock-up closed stores in cities including London, Cardiff, Manchester, Newcastle. They keep filling it out with the names of cities. Anyway, the headline is Armageddon.
Oh, very good. Very good. Top tier.
And I've got the equivalent story in The Sun, which is no time to pie.
Yes, because they're pinning it on Putin, aren't they?
Because they're saying it might be a spy thing, might be a Russian hack.
Yeah.
Start with Greggs, move on to Pressemanger, eventually MI5.
And on page 10 of The Star, and it's Vladimir Putin yet again, deluded Mad Vlad wants to create his own AI army in space. The increasingly cocky dictator is increasingly... That's not the first thing I would say of the murderous tyrant and genocidal monster.
Do you know the thing I don't like about him? He's increasingly cocky.
Bit cocky.
Bit arrogant.
The more I learn about this genocidal dictator, the less I care for him.
I wouldn't want to sit next to him at dinner. That's what I'm saying.
Absolutely.
Always talking about himself.
Wouldn't get his round in. Anyway, Vlad believes he could use AI to destroy the West by launching attacks from orbit, a top defense expert claims. And the headline is Space in Vladia. Space in Vlada, do you see?
Yes, I
Space
do.
In Vlada.
It's good written down.
But that is fits to be written down. It's not to be said by me. Space in Vlada, and with the caption, Lunacy Putin's on another planet. There you go. So, very good run there from The Star. Very
close. Knocking it out the park.
Solid work from The Star.
Matt, you've got the rest of The Sun.
Yep, so I've already said no time to pie. And this is my favourite headline I've seen for a while. It's in the Daily Mirror. And this is a story which has been all over the press, because it's a lovely story about... an island shop in Orkney that has ordered over 720 Easter eggs for an island that only has 500 inhabitants.
Oh, dear. Aww.
So they've got too many eggs, basically. And my favourite headline about this story is, I am the Eggman and this is the surplus. And the next one is a story about trapped Danny Dyer once had to smash his way out of a wardrobe after accidentally building it around himself.
I mean, how can you surely cannot improve on this story.
You painted yourself into a corner. I can understand building a wardrobe around yourself.
The quote is, I built myself into a wardrobe. I had to punch the back. I had to punch the back out of it to get out. My missus still mocks me to this day. It's a lovely story. It's a great headline. Danny Dyer's a Dyer DIYer.
That is outstanding.
Strong,
strong
Seriously
work.
Seriously good.
Word from The Sun, yes.
She's slightly crying. Yeah. Sorry. Now to the features sections, that crazy whirl of cosiness and self-loathing in the middle of the papers. And today we have a story from Ross Clark in The Telegraph about self-checkout machines. Matt, what's going on here?
Well, it's a classic Ross Clark moan. basically, modern life, essentially. Complaining about self-service checkouts, suggesting that 40% of people have admitted stealing stuff from a self-checkout machine or using what he called the banana trick, which I don't want to define, but I suppose I have to.
I think you must, because that sounds like it could be all sorts of things.
Yes, I'm not implying anything about Ross Clark.
Suggestive, yes.
Yeah, Ross Clark's personal life is his own issue. But apparently the banana trick is putting through something expensive as though something cheap. I'm sure we've all done that, either by mistake or deliberately.
But don't you then have to find something the same way? It's like Indiana Jones in Raiders of the Lost Ark, kind of with, you know, the bag of sand and the golden idol.
Exactly. Mm. And I don't think it probably works as well as it used to. Maybe it used to. But yeah, basically the story is that Booths, a supermarket chain in the north, recently announced it will remove self-service checkouts from all but two of its stores. American stores have started doing the same as well. And basically Ross is saying, well, good riddance. Mm. Thank goodness. Because I hate self-service checkouts for various reasons. But I think the problem is that quite a lot of this column is essentially It's a tradition of stories about like people not being able to cope with things and suggesting that that's some sort of major world problem, that everybody has the same problems. So there's quotes like, I can probably count on one hand the number of occasions I have succeeded in getting through without having to call an assistant.
What are you doing?
Suggesting you're not very good at it.
Yeah.
And then it isn't always clear which way you're supposed to scan your stuff. Sometimes going left or right, other times going right to left. That's literally not how barcodes work.
No. That it doesn't matter.
It really doesn't matter. So, yeah, and it just goes on and on and on about, you know, it's frustrating. It's an invitation for shoplifting. And he's suggesting that basically they're automating the wrong part of the business. It should be shelf stacking and warehouses that should be automated. Just to let you know, Ross, they already do that.
Yes.
They already automate warehouses, particularly in certain places. And real living human beings should be retained for customer-facing roles. Now, I'm not totally against that. I think, yeah, it makes sense that if you get rid of all the customer assistants, you're losing a lot of jobs there. Mm-hmm. And
also a lot of useful humans that can kind of tell you, you know, because sometimes you've got a question.
Absolutely.
And I
did find the, I don't know if you've seen these Amazon shops where they
very
become,
sinister.
They're very weird. And I've been into one once and it was quite a strange experience where you have to log into your Amazon account, click, you know, sort of scan a thing, and then you walk around, you just put things in your basket and walk out, and it automatically works out what you've taken and charges you, which is sort of the shop of the future, sort of the shop of a dystopia.
That's a fantastic excuse for like wholesale shoplifting. Oh, I thought it was an Amazon. Sorry, yeah. Mate. It's Aldi. I thought it was Amazon.
Yeah, exactly.
Astonishing thing about this story is it's like he's like, please destroy jobs, but not these ones. Destroy those other jobs over there. And the line about, you know, the delay and the confusion, it's just a temptation to shoplifting. This is the paper that when people pinch food because they're poor, wants them to be deported to Australia or hanged at the crossroads. But when it's Ross Clark and his posh mates who are slightly inconvenienced, then apparently theft is fine and very justifiable. And in fact, the fault of Archie Norman.
There is also a real sting in the tail at the end of this article, which is, I know that the Sharons and Traces of the checkouts used to be the butt of jokes, bywords for low ambition. I never guessed how much I would miss them. A real nasty little classist.
We really need those common little people, don't we?
Basically, this whole article is, why can't I have servants?
Yes.
Oh my God, that is a completely horrifying line.
It's a weird, horrible twist at the end. Just in case you were thinking, oh, he's really thinking about, you know, people need jobs and da, da. No. It's like, well, we used to take the piss out of them, but we miss them now, don't we?
And also, there's a really excellent feature today leading the Guardian's G2 section from Paper Cuts panellist and political sketch writer John Crace. John had a heart attack recently and he's written, I think it's an incredible piece, on not only on the kind of heart attack itself, but on the treatment he's had on the NHS and how it's made him reflect on life, love and so on. Yeah. You relate to this, don't you, Andrew?
Me and John Crace, we're now heart attack bros because I had one a couple of years ago and I identify strongly with this because it's kind of the same story. Mm. Although I wasn't in the gym, I was just like faffing around in London. And he had what is described as a mild heart attack. So it's not the kind of like collapse on the floor, clutching your chest. It's the, you know, the fizzy arm and the out of breath and then not getting back to kind of, after exertion, not getting back to the way you were beforehand. And he goes to hospital and has the exact same experience that I had, you know, checking for blood markers, waiting with multiple checks. And what's racing through his mind, and the headline is, you know, I feel no, my mind is racing. And the pull quote on the front is this how I die? And that, you know, no matter what, however mild it might turn out to be subsequently, that's racing through your mind. The thing that he has the same experience as me, because they have to tell you if you're going in for an angiogram and possible angioplasty. That's when they put the wire in the vein and they inject a dye into your blood so they can see exactly what's happening in your veins, your various ventricles and arteries. They have to warn you, there is a risk of death. Mm. And they warn John that there is a risk of death. When I had mine, they give you an iPad which walks you through it. And the battery kept running out when it said there's a risk of death.
Oh, God.
So about three times I had to hear, there is a risk of death. I'm like, can you stop telling me there's a risk of death? It's actually making me more likely to have another one if you keep telling me.
Oh, my God.
You've got a naturally thin vein, he's told, and one of your arteries is blocked, but I can fix it. With a stent, I ask? Better than that. I'm going to give you the VIP treatment. A stent costs the hospital £150 and giving you a drug that costs £1,100 and is more effective. Mm. So John is now having had, you know, it's quite a thing to have your confrontation with ultimate mortality, and you think, is this it? Is this game over now? What have I done? What have I not done? And the piece, you should read it. He talks a lot about that, about how it gives you a sense of perspective, and it really makes you reflect on where you've been and where you're going. Obviously, we want him back on here as soon as humanly possible. We wish him well.
But I would say, I mean, you know, it's an absolutely fantastic piece.
Yeah.
I found it really moving. But also, John, please take some time off and get better.
Although doing the show can be relaxing. It's not all shouting like it is today.
Although, stop showing off about your thin veins.
Flaunting his thin veins and leaving nothing to the imagination.
Yeah.
We'd love to see you back soon. Get well soon, John. And that's the end of today's Paper Cuts. Thanks to Andrew Harrison.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks to Matt Green.
Thank you.
And don't forget the Paper Cuts Supporters Club. Ditch those ads and get more fun bits from just £3.60 a month. Head over to papercutsshow.co.uk or follow the link in the show notes. We'd just like to thank some of our supporters for helping to make the show today.
Thanks and big up to, well, it says here, Peter Arlen Francis Nix. Now, that might be Peter Arlen and Francis Nix, or it might be somebody called Peter Arlen Francis Nix. We thank both or either of you.
Thanks very much from me to James Keeping.
And I would like to thank Anna Maria Trevor. I've been Alex von Tunzelman, and you've been listening to Paper Cuts on a day when the Star reveals that a coconut had to be removed from a man's bum after he inserted it during a sex game. Don't do that. The 56-year-old from Taiwan had to have the 7.5-centimetre nut extracted by doctors who commented sternly he was told not to do it again. I should coco.
Oh.
See you tomorrow.
Paper Cuts was written and presented by Alex von Tunzelman with Matt Green and Podmasters Group Editor Andrew Harrison. The producer was Liam Tate, assistant producer was Adam Wright, and audio producer was me, Jade Bailey. Music is by Simon Williams, design by Jim Parrott, with original art by Modern Toss. The executive producer is Martin Boytosh, and the managing editor is Jacob Jarvis. Paper Cuts is a Podmasters production.